Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Minnesota House of Representatives Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee for this March 24th, 2002. Our first item of business is taking the roll to establish a quorum. Mr. Dodge, please take the roll.
Chair Hornstein?
Present.
Hornstein, present. Vice Chair Cagle?
Present.
Cagle, present. Representative Petersburg?
Petersburg, present.
Petersburg, present. Representative Barr?
Here.
Barr, present. Representative Bernardi?
Present.
Bernardi, present. Representative Elkins?
Elkins, present.
Elkins, present. Representative Frederick?
Present.
Frederick, present. Representative Hausman?
Present.
Hausman, present. Representative Heinrich?
Heinrich, present.
Heinrich, present. Representative Kosnick?
Present.
Kosnick, present. Representative Mason?
Mason, present.
Mason, present. Representative Murphy?
Murphy, present.
Murphy, present. Representative Nelson?
Nelson, present.
Nelson, present. Representative Olson?
Olson, present.
Olson, present. Representative Richardson?
Present.
Richardson, present. Representative Torkelson?
Torkelson, present.
Torkelson, present. Representative West?
Present.
West, present. There is a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Dodge. Our next item of business is approval of the minutes from March 22nd. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the minutes of March 22nd meeting that is before us.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Is there discussion? Seeing none, members, this will be a voice vote. You can unmute. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All of those opposed, the motion prevails. Well, thank you, Representative Petersburg. So members, we have three bills on the agenda. They're pretty involved, so we'll spend roughly about a half hour on each of them, maybe a few minutes more, a few minutes less, depending on how the discussion goes. And our first bill is House File 4323, Representative Frederick. The motion for this bill is to move to Judiciary. The Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. So I will make that motion. And please tell us about House File 4323.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to give a brief backstory here. My involvement into politics in the first place came to because I was advocating for safe staffing numbers. I worked at the Maximum Security Psych Hospital in St. Peter, and I was seeing friends and coworkers getting assaulted and getting hurt on the job. Because we didn't have the right number of staff. And while we were part of a labor union and did advocacy through the labor union, we felt that not everything could be covered through collective bargaining. And so I, along with my colleagues, went up to the state capitol and started advocating for safety. So when the topic of safe staffing numbers came up in the specific context of rail and making sure that we have enough people to do the job, it hit a note with me that I was pretty happy to carry because I know how important it is to do any job safely with the adequate staffing. And so I know that we're going to hear testimony today talking about different technology and standards put in place to reduce the need for staffing on trains. Specifically, we will hear about positive train control and how that is a important safety measure that was implemented, and both sides will say, yes, it is good when it works. But I don't think it is at the level that justifies reducing staffing down to one person on a train. Additionally, we'll hear testimony regarding collective bargaining about how some of these staffing numbers should be handled at the collective bargaining table. And to a certain degree, I can understand that argument. But again, I cannot emphasize enough from my personal lived experience, not everything like that can be solved every time at the bargaining table. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to turn it over to any of my testifiers.
Thank you so much, Representative Frederick. We'll hear from the testifiers, and then we'll have a Q&A of the testifiers and the author and discussion of the bill. The first testifier is Nicholas, and I hope I get your name pronounced right, Kadich, the Minnesota Legislative Director for the Smart Transportation Division. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Nick Kadich, and I am a railroad conductor with a career spanning 21 years working in northern Minnesota. I'm now elected to represent conductors, engineers, and yardmasters as State Legislative Director for Smart Transportation Division. We respectfully ask you today to support House File 4323, requiring two persons on every freight train in Minnesota. This topic before you today is not new to this committee. Many of you have heard previous testimony why this issue is so important to public and worker safety. Please reference the handouts, including key facts, letters of support, and frequently asked questions. We as railroaders have felt the impact and unintentional consequences of new technologies over the past few years. Positive train control, trip optimizer, and handheld electronic devices all come with new responsibilities and duties on top of the normal operation of a train. When positive train control, or PTC, was introduced as a concept, it was a redundancy to enhance the safety of two-person crew trains. Trip optimizer, a fuel-saving program, handheld electronic devices to reduce paper usage. In practice, we found them to be additional tasks, creating a higher workload and compounding the need for two persons on every train. Freight trains in Minnesota are currently staffed with two crew members. While the two crew members function as a team, there are a few defined duties, such as one is responsible for operating the locomotive, essentially driving the train, and the other is responsible for the administrative duties to operate the train and also the physical work outside of the locomotive cab. While conversations have been had at the federal level, there is no existing regulation or law on crew size. Railroad and public safety have no place in collective bargaining. The public has a real interest in this issue, yet they have no seat at that bargaining table. Minimum crew size is just that, a safety minimum threshold to maintain existing standards and protect the public along with the worker. This is the appropriate forum to set a minimum standard in Minnesota that allows the railroads to continue operating as they have been, while also letting the public know the incredibly powerful and dangerous machines running through their communities and backyards have a minimum safety standard that is not subject to the whim of a corporation. Thank you for your time today, and I'm happy to answer your questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Our next testifier is Joel Mueller from the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Joel Mueller. Good afternoon, Chairman Hornstein and members of the committee. I want to thank you for taking the time to consider this bill. My name is Joel Mueller, and I am with the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen. I am a locomotive engineer. I have over 27 years of experience in this industry on two different railroads as a locomotive engineer, conductor, and a brakeman. This issue has been brought to this committee in the past, so I will be respectful of the committee's time and not bring up points that have already been on record. My goal today is to help shed light on the responsibilities of a locomotive engineer and the amount of concentration it takes to operate a freight train. You will see behind me a picture of a locomotive control stand. These are the controls that are standard on all locomotives. I would like to take the time to explain what these controls and computer screens do. Two computer screens in the front of the locomotive display the mechanical status of the locomotive, the speed of the train, the air pressure of the brakes on the front and rear of the train, the amount of power being used to move the train, and the braking effort used to slow the train down. These screens need to be constantly monitored because of the undulating nature of the territory freight trains operate over. When locomotives are positioned in the middle or at the rear of the train, this is called distributed power. When distributed power is used, one of these screens will display the controls for those locomotives. Distributed power is controlled independently of the locomotives at the head end of the train. When an engineer is operating a train with distributed power, he is in reality operating two to three trains at one time. To the left are the controls for the locomotives on the head end of the train. They include the reverser, throttle, dynamic brake, automatic brake or train brakes, independent brakes or locomotive brakes, bell, whistle, and light controls. The computer screen on top of that control stand displays positive train control information. The screen will display information such as authorized speed of the train, the aspects of the signals as the train approaches, and the limits of the train's authority. The screen will also display location of maintenance workers along the track. The screen is constantly changing and must be monitored at all times as the train moves down the line. In an attempt to operate trains more efficiently, railroads have added additional responsibilities to the engineer by introducing a technology called Trip Optimizer. This technology must also be monitored at all times and is demanding of the engineer's attention, adding to the task overload when operating a freight train. As you can see, these controls are extensive and requires the engineer's undivided attention. With all this technology at our fingertips, there's one aspect that is missing. What is happening outside the windshield? What is going on in the real world? It will not display a car racing to beat the train at a crossing. It will not display children that might be playing along the tracks. All it takes is a split second of advance warning to save somebody's life by blowing the whistle and warning them of the train's approach. It is essential to the safety of the public that a crew of two employees be maintained on all freight trains. A second set of eyes and ears to catch something the engineer might have missed. A set of checks and balances to assure safe operation of freight trains. I will close with a recall of an incident one of the members that I represent was involved in. The engineer was operating a train through Southwest Minnesota with a crew of an engineer and a conductor. The train wasn't approaching a siding where it would meet an opposing train and passing a location with construction workers working next to the track. The engineer was focused on slowing the train for the siding as well as monitoring the workers of the construction crew. The conductor spotted a switch that was misaligned before the engineer due to the curvature of the track, telling the engineer to apply the emergency brake, stopping the train just several feet before a building with several employees working in it. This is a real-world example where a second person on a train crew spotted a hazard and was before the engineer because he was focused on operation of the train. I want to thank the chairman, Chairman Hornstein, and members of this committee for giving me the opportunity to speak today, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mueller. Our next testifier is Claire Rubeck. She is with Citizens Acting for Rail Safety in the Twin Cities. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. I'm Claire Rubeck. Thank you, Chair Hornstein and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today on behalf of Citizens Acting for Rail Safety Twin Cities. I'm here to support House File 4323 for Minnesota legislations requiring minimum staffing on freight trains. I too have been before this committee before, and our organization is a grassroots, all-volunteer group of over 200 members. We live as far north as St. Cloud and down to Winona, and most of us are concentrated in the Twin Cities. So we have knowledge of the rural aspects and the urban aspects of freight trains moving through our communities. And I appreciate the past efforts that this committee has put toward rail safety. And I think this bill is a step towards improving what we already have on the books. Our concern is not only single person crew, but potentially in the future, zero person crew. And from our point of view, this indeed is not a labor issue. This is a public safety issue. And we don't have a table at the bargaining. So I appreciate those comments earlier. Our venue is here as your constituents, and we're asking that this bill advance forward. Positive train control has been mentioned, and I agree that it is not a substitute for human staffing on freight trains, especially high hazard freight trains. And the Association of American Railroads had set a policy to maintain two-person crew on any main track lines that did not have PTC. But now that PTC is in place, we're seeing what the demands are and that it is indeed not a safety substitute. In the packet that you have, I sent over a letter from our organization and a case study on the Castleton, North Dakota derailment that happened some years ago. But it's pertinent because it provides a scenario where there is lacking research on why multi-person crew is necessary and important to public safety. The lacking research is simply because the public and governmental agencies don't have access to the data that we would need to do a data-driven study. So all we can do is look to real-life events. And in this matter, the case study that I shared in the materials also has a link to the findings that the FRA had on the incident. What's unique about this unfortunate incident is that there happened to be five railroad crew. It was two trains. One train had three crew and the other train had two. The train with three had a trainee. Now these people activated after the derailment. There was a grain train and a high hazard freight train involved in the collision. And there was hazardous material tanks that were off the tracks. And because we had the man people power on the ground, they were able to use the DPU mechanisms that were described just earlier to remove the upstanding trains away from the spill and minimize the damage. Now, I won't go into further detail on this. It's available for you, but it lays out why having people on the ground in a very timely manner is important. This is also the right jurisdiction for this legislation now, because the courts have rejected the argument that this is preempted by federal preemption. So I would encourage Minnesota to join our neighbor, Wisconsin, and other Midwest states in setting minimum crew size for freight trains. I thank you very much for your careful consideration of this public safety matter. House File 4323 will improve the Minnesota rail safety program, and it just may save lives and our communities along the rail.
Thank you so much, Ms. Rubeck. Our final testifier is John Appitz, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Appitz. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is John Appitz. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association, the trade group for railroads here in Minnesota. And I want to thank you for this opportunity to speak in opposition to House File 4323, which would mandate two-person crews on all freight trains, operating in Minnesota. As has been said, and as many of you are aware, we've been over this ground several times in the past. And I think as time progresses, the arguments that we make in opposition to this just gain more support through everyday experience. When we began to talk about two-person crews about a decade ago, the idea of driverless trucks was a pipe dream. And the idea of positive train control, which you've heard about from the other members, was a long ways off. It was mandated in 2008 and was a long ways off. Earlier this month, C.H. Robinson announced that it was ready to begin testing self-driving trucks in Texas. I'm going to run them between Houston and Austin, I think, something like that. And PTC, positive train control, has been installed on all freight operations where hazardous materials, as prescribed by the Congress, are moved, including some of the short line railroads. So technology has brought us both safety and efficiency. And there's every reason to believe that that's going to continue on into the future. The issue of two-person crews, the issue of whether two-person crews are safer than single-person operations has been reviewed at length, and there's no data to show that this is the case. Actual experience, one-person operations are used every day in this country, and you see them, you experience them. Amtrak railroads operate with one person in the cab. The light rail lines that operate around the Twin Cities operate with one person in the cab. The vast majority of short lines that operate in Minnesota and across the country operate with one person in the cab. And internationally, this is the dominant practice. Germany, France, Switzerland, Austria, and all across the United Kingdom. One-person operations are standard operating practice. So why do we want to make Minnesota so different? This is not a safety issue. Safety remains the highest priority in the railroad industry, and even as the number of crew members has gone down, the number of accidents and incidents involving the public and involving crew members has gone down as well. Crew size has always been a collective bargaining matter. Claiming that suddenly it's become a public safety issue that has to be legislated by the states ignores both the legal and the labor history associated with rail operations. This is an issue currently before the Federal Railroad Administration and one that demands a national resolution. To have a patchwork of state laws prescribing how many people must be in a freight train flies in the face of the idea of free interstate commerce and the goal of better, smarter, safer, and more efficient rail operations. Mr. Chairman and members, the history of technology advances in the railroad industry, and you saw some of them in the picture that Joel presented to us, has gone hand in hand with the industry's record of safety improvements. 99.997% of all the hazardous materials moved in this country get to their destination safely and without incident. The long-term viability of this industry depends on our ability to adapt and compete in a rapidly changing technology sector. Technology and modern staffing methods have made railroads safer. They've made them more efficient. They've made them more productive. Crew size mandates would hinder these gains and divert traffic from trains to trucks, which are less fuel efficient. They add to congestion and rail hazards, and they further degrade the highways that we all travel on. It makes even less sense to freeze rail innovation at a time when the idea of autonomous trucks is receiving so much attention in the public sphere. Mr. Chairman and members, let's let the rail industry do its work. Let's let the Federal Railroad Administration do its work. Let's let collective bargaining do its work. And let's not stifle the advances in technology that have allowed this industry, the railroad industry, to become safer, cleaner, and move more freight more efficiently than it ever has before. Appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chair and members. And if there's questions, we'll be right here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Appitz. Members, that concludes our public testimony on the bill. So if members have any questions of any of the testifiers or the author, please proceed. I'm going to call on Representative Heinrich first, then Representative Petersburg, then Representative Mason. Representative Heinrich.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the author, Representative Frederick. Do you plan a bill in the future to maybe also have two members on our light rail trains or any passenger trains? And if not, why would that be? And if so, or maybe there's a difference there. So just wondering if you can explain the difference or why the push on some trains, but not others. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. So after discussions with the Minnesota Regional Railroad Association and Mr. Kajic, that language or an amendment, I should say, if all parties can agree to the language, that would carve out the short lines that has been talked about, I would be open to that language to carve that portion out. It is my understanding when this legislation has been introduced in the past, there has been similar wording to that extent, and I would be open to that on this bill.
Representative Heinrich, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, just real quick, Mr. Chair, and I don't know so much of a question, but, you know, we see MnDOT moving towards autonomous vehicles on the road here, even for semi-traffic and carrying very dangerous material out of the time. It seems to me that there might be a push in the future for maybe two-person crews on the highways. Maybe Representative Frederick, I guess if you'll yield one more time, is that a future, is that a concern of yours as well? And would we be seeing a possible bill in the future for that?
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So part of the language for the carve out for those short lines, there is a clause saying that if it's a hazardous material in some way, shape or form, that it would still require to have two people just for the safety of both the crew on the train and the public in general.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heinrich.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'll leave it at this. My question, Representative Frederick, had to do more with the possibility of here in the future as technology ramps up to have hazardous material on our, any material that is currently being trucked via semi. Maybe an assistant driver would be, I'm sure there we would be able to find that that might be a more safe route as well. So I was wondering if that was something you might be thinking about for the future, but I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chair, and let the other members jump in. Thank you for the time, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Representative Heinrich. And so we have four members with their hands up, and I think we have Representatives Petersburg, Mason, Olson, and Cagle. After Representative Cagle's question, we will wrap up and put this to a vote. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. And I think this is probably for Mr. Kadich. So I'm hearing that that really how you're promoting this is because of public safety. And so as I think about trains and public safety, I start thinking, well, okay, are we worrying about public safety on the railroad track itself? Most of the time that's out in the middle of nowhere. It goes back and forth and you don't really have much of an issue there for the public. But then there is also the connection between cars and railroads at crossings. Certainly there could be something there, but in that particular case, the driver of the vehicle is just as much at fault as anything else. So then to me, it seems like really what we're talking about is safety in regards to transportation of hazardous material and whether or not derailment comes and how that impacts local communities. And I got to thinking, you know, my understanding is that at least as much hazardous material is shipped by semi-truck as it is train, and yet we don't seem to worry about two-man crews there or any other kind of concerns in regards to hazardous material there. And certainly there's no involvement in a seat at the table during negotiations on whether or not there's a semi-driver there or not. So my question to Mr. Kadich is are you aware about the amount of incidents with hazardous material given by trucks as compared to trains? Because my understanding is trains are almost 100% effective in getting their materials safely to the final destination.
Mr. Kadich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Petersburg. When comparing trucks and trains, one of the key pieces of the second person of the crew is the ability to travel back up to a mile and a half to where the actual incident is. And when that person is back there, whether it's uncoupling cars or assessing a hazardous spill, or it could be something maybe even not hazardous, like a lumber car that's tipped over in the middle of a town. Whoever's back there assessing that and figuring out how to mitigate the damage and deal with first responders does not have control of that train. The person in the locomotive still has control of that train. I would think with a truck being a much smaller piece of equipment, it's kind of apples and oranges. Representative Petersburg.
Quick follow-up, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. That would be true if there was no such thing as cell phones. And my guess is that as soon as there's a derailment, the first thing that you do is you call for 911, call for local responders, and they will be assessed there. And a mile and a half back, it's going to take you more than a few minutes to get there. And my guess is that the first responders are going to be there before you are. And certainly they can contact you, whoever's in the head of the engine, to make whatever notifications is necessary. I just think our first responders are the ones that are needing to be there and dealing with this issue, and not two-man crews. And so that it's the same with semis and anything else in regards to that. I just don't see us needing to be involved in labor negotiations, especially when, generally speaking, Class 1 and Class 2 railroads are underneath the regulations and rules of the federal government and the federal system. Anyway, that's my two cents worth, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Representative Petersburg. Our next member is Representative Mason, followed by Representative Olson. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have two questions. One is, between point A and the final destination, can the engineer leave the cab?
I can answer that. Thank you, Chairman Hornstein and Representative Mason.
Mr. Mueller.
The engineer cannot leave the cab of the locomotive without securing the equipment. And you have to be outside the locomotive to secure the equipment by tying handbrakes on both the locomotives and the cars. So the answer is no, the engineer cannot leave the cab of the locomotive.
Representative Mason, you mentioned you had a second question.
I do.
Proceed.
I don't know if I've had, some of the trains I have seen have a lot of cars. The other question is, can the engineer, when he's in the cab, see from the beginning, and especially if it's going around a curve, can the engineer see the end of the train and what's happening there?
Do you want to take that again, Mr. Mueller?
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for the question. When I began my career, the longest train I worked on was 8,500 feet, a mile and a half long. I could not see the end of that train 27 years ago. The train's lengths have grown since that time, up to 3 miles long. So no, I cannot see the rear of a 3 mile long train either.
Okay. Thank you for your answer. And I think that poses some problems. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mason. We will turn to Representative Olson, then Representative Cagle. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I got a couple of really quick questions. The first one, did I hear you correct when you said that all freight trains in the state of Minnesota are currently have two members on them? And then the second part of that would be that if a company were to decide to go down to one member, would they be incurring more liability if something did in fact go wrong and it was their fault that went wrong? And then the last one is, how would this affect interstate trade if Wisconsin, for example, goes to requiring only one, but Minnesota is requiring two? How would that look? So those are three questions, Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson, thank you. Representative Olson, who are you addressing those questions to?
Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Mueller would probably be best capable of answering those questions.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Mueller, if you want to take a crack at those, you can ask Representative Olson to repeat the questions if you forgot them.
Sure. The first question, currently all freight trains are operated by Class 1 railroads, so that would be Union Pacific, Burlington Northern Santa Fe, Canadian Pacific, and Canadian National, and Amtrak are operated with a two-person crew nationally. I forget what your second question was. I apologize.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second question was, would the company like Union Pacific, would they incur extra liability if in fact they did downgrade to one person and that person fell asleep, had a heart attack, something of that nature? Would they incur extra liability if an incident did occur?
Mr. Mueller.
I don't know the answer to that question.
If there's anyone else who may know the answer, and I know Mr. Dahlberg from MnDOT is also on the line for questions. Anyone answer the question on liability? I think you stumped the panel, Representative.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Mr. Appitz will take a crack at it.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think it would change the liability prescription at all. Any of those questions get resolved through evidence presented, through conversation. I don't think of itself the move would be an increase in liability. There's plenty of other ways to create that sort of problem.
And then your third question, Representative Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the last question would be, how does that affect interstate trade if Wisconsin were to go down to a one-man crew, Minnesota requires two?
And I will open that up for anyone of the testifiers that feels that they are qualified or able to answer that question.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll take a shot at it if I may.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Olson, It would, as I mentioned in my testimony, it would just, this patchwork of one state having a requirement and another state having not having a requirement would just create a really inefficient patchwork. And that's why this is a really, really is a federal question. This is something that the Federal Railroad Administration needs to speak to. And I think at least we believe that's the case. The Federal Railroad Administration did speak to this during the last administration and noted that there was, they saw no need for based on the evidence, they saw no need for two-person crew mandates and, in fact, preempted state action across the board. That, however, has been drawn back, and the FRA is reconsidering its position. I do know that in a couple of states, Illinois in particular, the courts have determined that imposing something like this was an imposition on interstate commerce and that there is a federal preemption that would challenge this. So that was a ruling out of Illinois, I think about 6 months ago.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Apitz. Thank you, Representative Olson. The last question belongs to Vice Chair Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question, just kind of remembering things from years back. So when we did the autonomous truck pilot program, there still has to be a trucker in the car, exactly, or in the truck for those safety reasons. Excuse me. Another thing is that if a crash happens in a truck, it's likely to disable the vehicle. And so with a train, that's not necessarily the case. And you can, like, you know, somebody said earlier, you can see the end of a truck. You might not be able to see the end of the car. One other thing that I thought about, too, is... you know, a lot of these trains travel in rural areas where it might take a lot of time for emergency services to arrive. And if somebody's injured laying in the grass and somebody can't leave the engine, they're just supposed to sit there and watch that person, you know, suffer or die. And so, you know, it might take a while for emergency services to get there in some of these rural areas. And so, I don't know. I just see this as a safety issue. And then when Representative Olson brought up, you know, what if the engineer has a heart attack? Well, if they're the only person in there, good luck. So those are just some of my thoughts. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. We will give the author of the bill, Representative Frederick, the last word here, and then we'll move to a vote. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been a lot of talk about technology and where we might be in the future. And last I looked, we don't live in a world that looks like the Jetsons where there's cars floating in the air, although we may be there someday in the future, whether that's my kids or grandkids generation, who knows. So unfortunately, we have to create policy that reflects of the world that we live in today. And when it comes to what belongs in a collective bargaining agreement and what is not in there, there are things within workplaces that are not part of the collective bargaining agreement that are in state statute that they still have to follow. And so when it comes to safety issues, you have organizations like OSHA and everyone else that sets these basic minimum standards that affect unionized employees. And so I view this, when it comes to staffing, as something that we can say is a basic minimum for safety, and it is needed, and it is not something that, when it comes to safety issues, they shouldn't be negotiated at the bargaining table. So I think this is going to be a piece of legislation that benefits all Minnesotans, and I hope to have the committee's support.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. Mr. Dodge, I am renewing my motion that House File 4323 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. And Mr. Dodge, please take the roll.
Chair Hornstein?
Hornstein votes aye.
Hornstein, aye. Vice Chair Cagle?
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Petersburg?
Petersburg, no.
Petersburg, nay. Representative Barr?
No.
Barr, nay. Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Bernardi, aye. Representative Elkins?
Elkins, aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hausman?
Aye.
Hausman, aye. Representative Heinrich?
Heinrich, no.
Heinrich, nay. Representative Kosnick?
No.
Kosnick, nay. Representative Mason?
Mason, aye.
Mason, aye. Representative Murphy?
Murphy, aye.
Murphy, aye. Representative Nelson?
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Olson?
Olson, no.
Olson, nay. Representative Richardson?
Aye.
Richardson, aye. Representative Torkelson?
Torkelson, no.
Torkelson, nay. Representative West?
West, aye.
West, aye. There are 11 ayes and 6 nays.
There being 11 ayes and 6 nays, the motion is approved. Thank you, Representative Frederick. And Representative Frederick, you can stay in the virtual testifiers table because the next bill is also yours. This is House File 3430.
He's at home.
Yes. House File 3413. We will be laying this bill over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And I understand, Representative Frederick, you've got a couple of amendments you'd like to offer. So why don't you discuss those quickly, and then we'll amend them and get the bill in the shape you'd like us to consider it. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendments do two things. One is they incorporate feedback that some of the committee members provided. And then the second amendment is a simple drafting error that I appreciate the committee staff for catching.
We're going to do two separate voice votes on this, members. Is there any discussion? First is the A1 amendment that Representative Frederick said input from some committee members. No discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All of those opposed, the motion prevails. And then the second is the A2 amendment. As Representative Frederick said, this is more of a technical issue. Discussion. Okay, seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All of those opposed, the motion prevails. We now have House File 3413 as amended before us. Representative Frederick, tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. So as part of a larger package of bills that I'm working on relating to substance use disorder treatment, this particular bill looks at a person's life after they successfully complete treatment. Unfortunately, people who have gone through SUD treatment have experienced periods of time of homelessness. And during those times, they might have lost or had their identification stolen. Another bill that I'm working on helps them getting their birth record. And the bill before us then is helping them get their state issued ID. That with the goal being that they need some form of state issued ID then to be able to get full employment. So again, this is part of a bigger package of bills that I'm trying to build up a support system for people once they successfully complete that treatment, because unfortunately, as the current system sits after they complete treatment, they're just left to their own laurels and just hope for the best. And so putting a supports network in place, we think whether it is housing or food supports or childcare even is part of this bill, it's all kind of taken a holistic approach. And this is just one piece of that overall picture. So, Mr. Chair, I would turn it over to my testifier.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. So we have two members of the public that have signed up to testify. The first is Brian Zerbis from March. And welcome to the committee and good to see you. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Amy Delwall. I'm the second testifier.
I see.
And my colleague, Brian Zerbis, is actually in another committee testifying right now on a similar bill.
Okay. Well,
so I will be taking testimony today or offering testimony today at your.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Delwo, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. My name is Amy Delwo. I work for NewWay, which is a substance use disorder treatment provider, as their vice president of public policy. However, today I'm here as the president-elect of March, and I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair, for your generous time offering this bill a hearing today. I also would like to thank Representative Frederick for authoring this bill. I think that Representative Frederick framed this nicely. I'll add that we conducted some focus groups with patients in care late last year, and in fact, 400 of them, and 90% of them were on medical assistance. And we were asking, what are some of the barriers to long-term remission when a person has exited treatment? And identification was one of those that is a barrier. Of course, as you've heard from Representative Frederick, that oftentimes you need identification in order to begin employment or to secure housing. And absent those things, it becomes a cyclical trigger to a recurrence of symptoms. And so therefore we brought this bill forward in response to that. For some contextualization, this waiving of fees for these individuals is for those that are medical assistance eligible. In order to be financially eligible for medical assistance, the limit in terms of your income is $13,590 a year. And when you're on medical assistance, and if you're receiving some degree of housing support, you are limited to, as of January 1 of this year, to $111 of a personal needs allowance. So that $111 that you're able to retain allows you to, if you need a new pair of jeans, if you need some additional food, if you need a new toothbrush, it needs to cover all of your expenses during that month. And so reducing this barrier for people helps to set them on a path to long-term remission. I will note a couple other things. One is that this bill was patterned after the homeless youth legislation that had passed last year related to a similar waiving of fees. And Mr. Chair, I will stand for questions. And once again, thank you and the committee members for your time and attention to this today.
Thank you, Ms. Delwo. So I do not see any other members of the public who have signed up to testify on this bill. So I do see a question from Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I certainly agree that I think identification probably or lack of is a difficult situation for people that get benefits and so forth. The fee for a replacement driver's license or ID, I think, is $6.50. And so my question is, if it's so important, and even the Department of Human Services says it's an important piece, wouldn't it be better for us to just have them increase that reimbursement from out of Health and Human Services for that $6.50, allow the system that we now presently have stay intact without creating an actual bigger bureaucracy and trying to determine who gets free replacement and who doesn't? It just seems to make sense that if you're in medical assistance, that ought to be one of the allowable expenses that you could get reimbursed from, rather than changing it all in the Department of Transportation, which isn't even part of Medicaid system. It seems to be much easier to do that internally, that direction. What are your thoughts?
Was that directed to Ms. Delwo?
Yes, please.
Ms. Delwo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg. A couple things. I did reach out to the Department of Human Services with regard to Medicaid and whether or not that is an expense that would be reimbursed, and it is not. And in terms of the personal needs allowance, I believe that is also has some federal stipulations around it that doesn't allow us to exceed the $111 at this point.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Petersburg.
That's correct. That could be correct. However, currently, current law says you can't waive the fee for those on Medicaid for driver's licenses either. And so you're going to the legislature to change that. So therefore, you could go to the Department of Health and Human Services and get that changed as well. My question is why you chose this avenue rather than going to Health and Human Services and say, hey, even your own information says it's important for them to have identification. Why don't we get legislation to increase reimbursement by $6.50 rather than creating a change in bureaucracy and red tape at the Department of Transportation? That was my question. I don't know if you have an answer for that, but that's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative Frederick, did you want to respond?
Yeah, I'd like to, Mr. Chair. So when it comes to the approach, I appreciate and I'm glad that we can both agree that we identify that the need is there and that there's support for this, and it's just kind of a discussion about what's the best way to get to that endpoint. So I just want to acknowledge that and say I'm glad that we're on the same page there. And I would say that you're right, that there are multiple ways that we can try to get this done. In conversations with DHS on other aspects of this bill, there was quite a bit of bureaucracy that we were going to have to fight through to get some of this done. And so the hope was to be able to go this route with this particular aspect of my, with the goals with our regarding SUD treatment, that this might be the most efficient, that we're not putting everything that we're doing on simply one department.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. If you have a very quick response, Representative Petersburg, and then we'll move on.
Well, thank you. But Mr. Chair, and to Representative Frederick, DHS already has the information about whether or not they're on Medicaid or not. And so now you're requiring another level of bureaucracy in the Department of Transportation, having to first verify that they're on it, et cetera. So it just, that I'm sorry, that doesn't hold water, and I disagree. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. I do not see any other, that's Representative Petersburg's hand. I don't see any other members' hands. So Representative Frederick, do you want to close us out here on House File 3474?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members for hearing the bill today. Again, this is just one piece of an overarching effort to try to reform how the state provides SUD services. And so I would hope that I can have the committee support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And so we will be laying over House File 3474 as amended for possible.
Mr. Chair, House File 3413. This is John.
I'm sorry. I'm looking
at House File 3413.
Sorry about that. I'm jumping ahead. I'm so excited about Representative Torkelson's bill. House File 3413, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. So thank you very much, Ms. Delwo. Thank you, Representative Frederick. And now we will spend the balance of our hearing on House File 3474. Representative Torkelson, welcome. And first of all, I want to thank you for a lot of work that you've done on the Corridors of Commerce program. And you've worked hard on this bill, and I'm glad that we are able to hear it. And I know that you have a DE4 amendment. So if you want to just present the amendment, and then we'll vote on it, and we can get to conversation about your bill.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. By the way, the motion is to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus transportation bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the DE4 to get it before us.
Okay, is there discussion, members? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All of those opposed, the motion prevails. We have House File 3474 as amended before us. Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Please tell us about your bill as amended.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. First off, thank you for hearing this bill today, and thank you for your vote of confidence in allowing me to work on this and present it to the committee. It's something I've been working on actually for quite a while, since well before session, but it's been quite a journey, but I think we are at a point at least where we can begin some more serious discussions. Just a very brief review. We've talked about corridors in this committee before, but just a very brief review of kind of where we're at and how we got here. First off, thanks to you, Mr. Chair, for being among the people that founded Corridors of Commerce back in 2013. The program has proved to be quite successful over the period that it's been in use. We've spent over $1.1 billion on various transportation projects around the state of Minnesota. These are mostly projects that otherwise probably wouldn't have gotten done, at least maybe not done as quickly. And it's proven to be quite successful. However, each time we've taken the ship out sailing, it seems like we've had to do a little remodeling. And some of those journeys have been smoother and more successful than others. But all in all, over time, Corridors has taken on, I think, a life of its own. It's a program that is worth fixing, worth improving on. And that's really what my efforts are about today. So the revision of Corridors program that I'm working on is designed to improve the delivery of resources and allow MnDOT to implement the program effectively. Past rounds of allocation were criticized for perceived lack of regional balance and involved a cumbersome process of rating that included too many projects. The last go around, MnDOT had to rate 174 projects in a short amount of time. Some of those projects overlapped. And in fact, I believe the department spent well over $1 million just putting the list together, mostly because there were so many projects on the list. So part of this effort today in this language is to make the process usable for MnDOT. And first item in that process is to try and filter down the number of projects that MnDOT would have to evaluate. And if Mr. Howe would be so kind as to put up the first map. This is a map of the department's ATP areas that are scattered around the state. There are eight of them plus the Metro District. And the idea that was in actually started with the department itself and was in their original language is to have each ATP, all eight of them around the state, recommend three projects each. So as proposed projects come in, they would go to the ATPs, and the ATPs would filter down to three projects from their district. The challenge then became, how do we do it with the Metro District? And what I've settled on is that the TAB, the Transportation Advisory Board, which advises the Met Council, so via Met Council, we'd get three recommendations. And then each of the counties that are included in the Metro District would recommend two projects. So this is, the total number is significantly less than the total of projects that were originally, or were proposed last time and evaluated by MnDOT. I might have misspoken, actually the TAB is getting four projects, and that's on lines 1.17 through 1.19. Another question has been, you know, where does MnDOT find the funds to actually put the list together? We address that in this amendment by allowing them to utilize a portion of the 17% they already get for program delivery. We're just adding language on lines 2.16 through 2.18 that allows them to use a portion of that 17% for project scoring, ranking, and selection. Next, the question is, you know, which roads get included? So if Mr. Howe would go to the next map, the interregional corridor system, this system of roads is the original set of roads that was included in the corridors program with some very slight revisions over time. As I looked at this, I really felt that the map was somewhat incomplete. I first noticed that Highway 14 ended in New Ulm. And I know, because it's in my district, that Highway 14 keeps on going to the west and is a road that is an important corridor of commerce for western Minnesota. You might also notice that roads like Highway 12 are not included on this map. And so instead of utilizing this map, legislation would switch to another map that is kept at the federal level. And if Mr. Howard switched to the next map, thank you, Mr. Howe. This is the National Highway System map for Minnesota. And you'll see that there are a number of roads on this map that are not included on the previous map. There are just a couple of very small exceptions where there was a road on that first map that's not on the second one. But overall, it's a much more inclusive map that includes roads that are really important to Minnesota's commerce. You will see roads like I mentioned earlier, and also Highway 5 coming into the metro is on this map, but it's not on the other one. So I'm suggesting that we utilize this set of roads. It just really is going to give these ATPs and counties a little bit more territory to work with, more road miles to consider, and I think will result in a better set of projects at the end of the day. The other issue that came up is what about projects that are proposed but aren't really ready for prime time? So there's language in the bill that only projects that have a reasonable estimate of total project cost can be included for recommendation. So if a project is submitted that really isn't, like, the department cannot scope and price quickly enough, that project would not be included as an eligible project for that round of allocation. Then the other big question, of course, has been, what does regional balance really mean and how do we get there? If you remember, the map that came out a few years ago looked like what I call the blueberry in the bowl of tomato soup map, where all the projects were crowded in and around the metro area with really nothing in outstate Minnesota. We kind of fixed that with a second allocation the next year, but the problem is in the way the department was defining regional balance. They had what I think was too, was not balanced. So what I'm proposing in this particular language is that we divide the pot into the money into three pots. One pot being metro projects, that would be projects that are within or connected to the interstate beltline. A second pot are metro connector projects, projects that improve access to the metro and are within 40 miles. And let's have the next map up, please, Mr. Howe. It's a little hard to see, but the outline, the dark blue outline you see on this map is the metro district that in the past has been where half of the money would go. There's a faint line that is a 40-mile radius around the beltline. And that will bring in a significant amount of territory that is adjacent to the metro and would include roads that would connect the metro to the rest of Minnesota. And finally, the third pot would be regional center projects. And that's all projects really that are not included in the first two categories. I've assigned percentages to those three areas in language. And then there is quite a bit of flexibility built in. The department doesn't have to come up with exact numbers. They can average those numbers over three project cycles. The other ongoing question has been one of legislative input. The earmark discussion that many of us have taken part in over the years, where some legislators love earmarks and others don't love them so much. I've tried to address that a bit here in allowing or actually requiring that the ATPs, the counties, and the TAB pay attention to legislators' thoughts, take input from legislators, and if a legislator objects to a project that is submitted or funded, that that information would have to be included with what is submitted to MnDOT. And the last point I'll make is that MnDOT's the timeline in the original legislation is really too tight to get all this work done in a timely fashion. So I've extended the deadline from August 1st of 22 out to February 1st of 23, giving MnDOT an additional 6 months to get through this new process. You might notice there's a letter from Itasca County that came in since this was introduced, and really introducing a topic that I decided the last day or so not to include in this legislation, and that's to create another pot of money that MnDOT would be allowed to utilize for project development. If these projects that are good ideas but haven't been properly scoped come in, MnDOT could have a pot of money to develop those projects and get them shelf ready, but I decided that that was not really necessary for this particular effort. Mr. Chair, that really concludes my remarks regarding the DE. I realize it's a lot of information, and I'm happy to stand for questions, although I do believe we have a couple of testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Let's hear from your testifiers, and then we will proceed to any committee questions. So the first person on the list is Shane Zart from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities.
Thank you, Chair and members. Again, my name is Shane Zart. I'm with the firm Plarity and Hood, and I'm testifying today on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, which is an organization of more than 110 cities outside of the Twin Cities metro area. And CGMC has supported the Corridors of Commerce program since its creation, Mr. Chair, when you were chair previously in 2013, because, and Representative Torkelson mentioned this, because it has helped fund a number of those projects out there that we frankly never thought we'd see funded. But he also summed it up well when he said this program is worth fixing. And frankly, the underlying program has lost the trust of advocates, legislators, even the department. And I think that's what brings us here today. So I first want to thank MnDOT for coming forward with the suggested reforms contained in the underlying bill, which are, I think, a good faith effort to solve some of the issues with the program. And a special thanks to Representative Torkelson. I don't think anyone has put as much thought or work into how to reform this program over the years than he has. So I'll walk through a couple of the specifics in the bill and or in the DE amendment, I should say, and then maybe note a couple things that are not in the bill as well. And first is just to acknowledge the change that Representative Torkelson summarized well, which is the shift in the bill for Greater Minnesota Project eligibility from the interregional corridor system to the national highway system. We would support in general broadening that eligibility to a wider scope of projects, as long as it's coupled with some of the other changes in the bill, which is the efforts to be able to narrow the list of projects through the ATPs and ease that burden on MnDOT, even from the administrative side as well. And that is a legitimate issue. As you heard, I think it was over 170, Representative Torkelson, that you cited that the department had to score last time. And that's because as the current program works, anyone can suggest a project. It can be a member of the general public, local government, just about anyone. So we do think, and this was in both MnDOT's language and Representative Torkelson's, working through those ATPs is a pretty elegant solution to that, and the membership of those ATPs additionally tends to include a number of local officials and I think make sure that the projects that they are coming forward have local and regional support as well. Now, Representative Torkelson takes that a step further, or maybe puts a little twist on MnDOT's language with your DE amendment, which is preserve some of that pieces of the process that were truly public and allow members of the general public, corridor coalitions, local governments to submit projects. Not just the ATPs, but still includes some of the screening to narrow that list of projects. And we're open to either approach, but I think we would lean in favor of Representative Torkelson simply because it layers on those additional channels for public input while maintaining some guardrails and efficiencies in the process. But to kind of start to wrap things up in my comments, one of the things underlying today's discussion is that the corridors, I feel, faces a bit of an identity crisis. You know, I think when Corridors has received a lot of its biggest accolades is when it does big things. You know, when it funds the long-awaited projects like the 14s and the 23s that we are sick of hearing about. But you know, one of the things that a lot of our members talk about too is between 2013 and 2017, the program often did big and small things. And you know, that's fund some of those big expansion projects and put forward some smaller awards. Those $2 or $3 million awards or even less to advance projects toward readiness in addition to advancing projects forward. And to put some numbers to that, I think it's illustrative to look at between 2013 and 17, $331 million was allocated to the program, and that got spread across 27 projects, large and small and of different types. After 2017's changes to the program, more than $800 million was put toward Corridors of Commerce and funded just seven very large projects. And we support a lot of those projects, but it does kind of drive home the point that if we want corridors to do things both big and small and help advance the next set of projects while we're doing the ones that are in front of us now, that's, I think, something that we will have to address legislatively this session. And one of the ways that MnDOT tried to get at that was a small projects category for Greater Minnesota projects. And we appreciate the intent of that suggestion, but we do feel that if we're going to set aside program project dollars, there's a meritorious discussion in saying, should it be for a small projects category like that, or should we do something more that Representative Torkelson was reflected in Itasca County's letter, which is put it more towards project advancement and getting those advancing project readiness. So now, finally, I think I'll conclude and by saying, obviously, regional balance is paramount to our members in Greater Minnesota. But Representative Torkelson might be onto something by moving away from that traditional 50-50 split between Metro and Greater Minnesota, creating three separate project categories and recognizing Metro connector projects. Kind of brings to mind Highway 212, which, there's portions of that in Carver County that are technically in the metro area, but you'll find folks in Olivia, Renville, Granite Falls who are just as passionate about fixing that project as anyone else, because they rely on it to access the metro or come visit you at the Capitol when we can do that in person. And separating those projects out would hopefully solve one of those problems, which is forcing those rural projects to compete head-to-head with metro adjacent projects that have much higher traffic counts and the like. So with that, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't end by saying, if we are going to split the pot three ways instead of two, or even if we're going to move ahead how it is, there's a $200 million project selection round kind of on tap. And as you know, that was a part of last year's transportation bill and is set to go forward later this year. And again, I'd be remiss if I didn't say that ask the committee to increase that amount in whatever form the program moves forward. I think in order to get to the maximum number of projects and with the state on solid fiscal footing, additional allocations would go a long way this year. So I'll thank you and I'll leave it there and I'll hang around for questions as well.
Thank you so much for your testimony and your work over the years on this program. Very much appreciated. Our final testifier is Patrick Weidman from MnDOT.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Patrick Weidman with MnDOT's Office of Transportation System Management. My section is responsible for the administration of the Corridors of Commerce program. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the department wishes to go in on the record in support of this bill. As was mentioned in my presentation to this committee back on March 3rd, MnDOT identified some big issues coming out of the previous selection, scoring, and ranking and process from Corridors of Commerce. This bill addresses our two biggest concerns with the Corridors of Commerce program as it is. The first being reducing the total number of project recommendations MnDOT was expected to develop, evaluate, score, and rank. As Representative Torkelson stated, we had to do 174 projects last time, and that just about broke the department. It was very strenuous to do that. Our second big issue was the infamous regional balance. That was a tough one for the department. We didn't have a lot of legislative direction. And we feel this bill gives the department some very good sound footing in terms of identifying what is intended by the legislation for regional balance. We feel the bill overall successfully meets and addresses our biggest concern. We'd like to extend our sincere appreciation and thanks to Representative Torkelson for both his leadership on this, as well as his willingness and commitment of time to work with us on trying to make Corridors of Commerce program better. We know as a program, the legislature and the state as a whole likes the program. We just want to make it work better for us. And so thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Both myself and Eric Redeen will stand by today for questions should you have any.
Thank you so much, Mr. Weidman. Members, do you have any questions of any of the testifiers or of Representative Torkelson? I see several hands. We'll start with Chair Mary Murphy. Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Torkelson. I found my first answer was what ATP meant. I finally found that. But you spoke so fast when you were going over the maps, and your maps are half color, and my maps don't have color. So I'm having a problem telling which map goes where. And I just want the winners. I know that we're splitting up all the districts and we're having fewer roads than we had at one time, but which maps are we really considering for your amendment for real?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Proceed, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Murphy, for your question. I realize I did put out a lot of information in a short time, but our time is limited, of course. If Mr. Howe could put back up first the interregional corridor map there. That's the map that displays the roads that were eligible for corridors of commerce funding in the past. That was developed by the department back in 2013, has had just some minor revisions since then. And it's basically a connect the dots map. They put the dots of the regional centers on the map and then highlighted the roads that connected them. Uh-huh. I'm suggesting we go to a broader set of roads for consideration. And if Mr. Howe would go to the next map, and I forget the title of it, whatever it's called, all the red lines on it, Mr. Howe. The National Highway System map is actually a federal map. And all we're really doing here is making the pot of roads that are available for consideration a much larger selection of roads. So if you look at there in northern Minnesota, there are more roads that would be considered as eligible for corridors funding than there were in the past. I think that is a benefit, especially to greater Minnesota, and that's why that I'm suggesting we switched to this map that has more roads on it that would be eligible for corridors funding. Doesn't mean they're all going to get funded, of course. It's a selective process.
Right. Okay, I understand that, and I agree with that one. Then the one with the big circle with the 40 miles outside the metro area, that's what we would consider for the metro area then?
So, Mr. Chair.
Proceed, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm suggesting three categories. The first category is determined by the Beltline, and that's the red line around Metro District, the 494-694 Beltline. So that first category would include projects that are either inside the Beltline or directly attached to it.
Okay.
The second category would be what we're calling connector routes. And we've come up with the 40-mile buffer around the metro that is a line that is 40 miles from the Beltline, and that would be the second category of projects. We've seen in the past there's really heavy demand for road projects adjacent to the metro, but the metro district itself isn't quite large enough to incorporate what I think would be a reasonable area for those. So we've selected this 40-mile radius around the Beltline for the second set of projects. And then finally, the third category is everything outside of that.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Quick follow-up, Representative Murphy.
One follow-up then. Would these same maps regulate the projects going to the Bonding and Capital Investment Committee?
Mr. Chair.
Go proceed, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, there's really no connection unless the Capital Investment Committee would designate more funds for the corridors program. Then, of course, these maps would direct those funds. if the funds go just to local roads or local bridges or the state construction fund, these maps would have no impact.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, for the clarifications. I appreciate them very much.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Our next question comes from Representative Petersburg and then Vice Chair Cagle. And probably at that point, we will ask Representative Torkelson to give some closing comments. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I first want to start off by giving my kudos and great thanks to Representative Torkelson for his hard work. I know the amount of time that he spent because I walked by his office and he's been on them and he's kind of run by a few ideas with me too. But this really was a lot of hard work with him getting and talking with the various people, including the department. And so I appreciate that. My comment was just a little bit about something that is not in this bill that has been some talk about. And that is, Mr. Chair, if you remember, you and I were on the Transportation Committee when we created, when you created this. And the first $300 million or so was for basically shovel-ready projects, and almost all of them were smaller projects. And so as that developed, we also realized that in order to get projects shovel-ready, there needed to be some cash available for engineering and land purchase and so forth. And so quite a few years ago, we did get $25 million put into the Corridors of Commerce of cash that are designed for some of those projects. So some of the things that we're talking about that aren't quite shovel ready that we really want to have going into the future, I think the department has some funds that could be used for that if they so choose. And in talking to them, they have been including that $25 million into major projects. But after 23 or 24, that could start being used for exactly those projects. And so I think that's really a benefit to us in that particular program. And, but I think overall, the issues that Representative Torkelson fixed in this bill is really a really good thing. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Vice Chair Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Torkelson, Mr. Howe, could you toss that 40-mile map back up? So kind of looking at this, let's just pick some random road in the North Metro that is within the Metro District and outside that Metro District. Let's just say Highway 65. Would this incentivize some coordination along the corridor? So like if there's an organization, let's say like the North Metro Mayors Association that's been advocating for this stretch, all the way from the Hennepin County border up to East Bethel or Ham Lake. Could you imagine that they could work together on something like this to kind of increase their competitiveness?
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you, Vice Chair Cagle, for the question. The exact impact of this on various people that are in organizations that are interested in highway projects, of course, remains to be seen. Certainly, I think we welcome as much input as possible. As to, you know, the 40-mile buffer line is somewhat arbitrary. There could very easily be a project that would cross that line, or there could be a project that extends well beyond it and would be kind of in two categories. Exactly how the department might handle that is going to have to be up to the department, actually. I would guess, I don't know, but I would guess they would just kind of categorize it as being part of coming out of two pots, so to speak. But as far as project proposers, they will either be proposing projects to the county or to the ATP or in some cases both. And I don't think that's necessarily bad. I think the more consideration projects get and support they get from local organizations, the better. I would highlight the various coalitions that have been formed here and there in Minnesota, Highway 14, Highway 23, 169, and others. But those efforts seem to have been quite successful, and I think they are successful because they bring a variety of interest groups on board with a single focus, and I encourage that sort of activity.
Thank you.
Okay, members, I am not seeing any. Oh, Representative Koznick, I see your hand up.
Yeah, thank you. And I know we're getting close to the end time. Just I do appreciate the presentation. It's very thorough and helpful to understand as we were just looking at this. I also recognize the need to narrow the number of projects to be scored. So I think that's a good good element of the bill, Representative Torkelson. Can we break down, just to clarify from what I'm thinking, is there a total of 41 projects that would be selected now? And how does that break down? Like the four, the Met Council gets four, the Metro counties get 16, and then how many would be to the other ATPs, if I'm understanding that part right?
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, you are understanding that right. So I might have miscalculated, actually, because I think there's eight ATPs, which would be 24 projects. And if you add that all up, it comes up to 44, I think, if I'm not. I hate doing math in public because I usually make a mistake, Mr. Chair.
I make a mistake in private with math.
Mr. Chair, this is Patrick Weideman.
Proceed, Mr. Weideman.
I'll clarify for Representative Torkelson. There are seven ATPs in Greater Minnesota, and the eighth ATP is actually the metro area. So it would be seven times three is 21, and then the 20 projects in the metro area for a total of 41.
Okay, well, there you have it. Representative Koznick, did you have a follow-up?
That's kind of the way I did the math, just called it different different areas. I wasn't sure how many ATPs there were, but I thought it was 21 there. And then just real briefly, the funding allocation, I appreciate the creativity. You've got 30 to 35% in the metro, then that second ring within the 40-mile radius is another 30 to 35%. So could be 60 to 70% within that region. Is that my understanding then?
Are you directing that to?
To the author or?
Or, okay,
Department of State.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Koznick. That's correct. So under that scenario, the Greater Minnesota set could go up to 40% potentially, but it could also be only 30. So the last category is at least 30%.
Okay. Well,
and I just add another quick comment. You know, to the size of projects, the department originally was going to have a small project category with projects 10 million and under. I just feel that's kind of arbitrary. The size of projects varies. It's the importance of projects that I think we should be interested in. And I'm fine doing small projects through corridors. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I would hope that moving forward that if an ATP or a county recommends a small project, if it scores well, it should be funded.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Well, we are almost at time. I'm going to scan the committee one more time, and I don't see any further questions. So, Representative Torkelson, if you have any final thoughts you want to share with us, this bill is being laid over. It's a very important bill, and I think, you know, may certainly between now and the time we put our bill together, if there are additional comments from committee meetings, advice, suggestions, members of the public and MnDOT. I think we want to make sure that we cross the T's and dot the I's and make sure that this important program is able to move forward in a way that really empowers our communities and those who have benefited from the program and those who stand to benefit from the program. So I thank you again, Representative Torkelson, and if you have any thoughts to bring us home here.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just back up what you just said, and that is that this is really still a work in progress. It's been quite a bit of work getting it to this point, but certainly I'm willing to take other ideas into consideration. There's always room for improvement. We do have, we'll probably be getting some kind of a reception across the street. I don't know if it'll be positive or negative or somewhere in between. This is quite fresh. A lot of people are just digesting it as we speak. But anyone listening or anyone on the committee that has ideas, please bring them to me. I'm I'm always looking for improvements. And I want to, again, thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this bill. And thank you for your confidence in me by allowing me to kind of move forward on my own up to this point. So,
well, you're doing important work. Thank you for that. So, members, we are laying over House File 3474 as amended. I just want to remind everyone that we do have a special Friday edition of the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee tomorrow. We're meeting from 10:30 to 12 in the morning, and we have four bills on the agenda. And nope, I can't count. Three bills on the agenda, all pretty much relating to safety, pedestrian safety, speeding, work zone safety, et cetera. So that'll be the theme for tomorrow. And look forward to seeing you then at 10:30. And with that, members, our meeting is adjourned. Oh, one last thing. We are going to be meeting then also just a reminder, a week from tomorrow, Friday, April 1st, we have an extra meeting as well.